If you care about journalism or just want help making sense of the noise in today's media landscape, Inkstained Riches is your guide. Each week, Eliana Johnson and Chris Steierwalt break down where the news media is falling short and occasionally where it's getting it right. Emphasis on occasionally. Their goal is to help you become a smarter, more critical news consumer. They care about good journalism because they're ink-stained wretches themselves, and they love the news business, even when it drives them crazy. Every episode covers the biggest media stories of the week, a deep dive into their latest obsessions, and a segment where Chris makes them say something nice. Because, believe it or not, there's still good work out there. For the best and worst of journalism today, search Wretches wherever you get your podcasts. On a fall afternoon in 1973, John Douglas is driving his 15-year-old son around New York. Suddenly, something catches his ear on the radio. A warning. What you're about to hear contains potentially offensive language.
There are words that you can say, no problem. Topography! No one has ever gone to jail for screaming topography.
It's George Carlin with a bit that has since become one of the most famous stand-up routines of all time.
But there are some words that you can go to jail for.
John keeps listening.
But I was just trying to find out which words they were. For sure, all of them. I wanted a list, because nobody gives you a list.
Carlin points out that society has more terms to describe obscene words than obscene words themselves.
Dirty, filthy, foul, vile, vulgar.
The list goes on endlessly.
Cursing, cussing, swearing, and all I could think of was a motherfucker.
Except what John and his son hear that day in 1973, it's not bleeped. Appalled, John shuts off the radio. And this is a problem, because John is a member of a watchdog group. It's called Morality in Media, and as you might guess from the name, they are not huge fans of the seven words George Carlin just listed. John reports the broadcast to the FCC, which triggers a legal battle that ends up at the Supreme Court, which rules that the FCC can regulate indecent content on the radio. Decades later, that case very nearly led to a world where the only thing you could find online would be Sesame Street videos and knitting tutorials. I'm Mike Masnick. This is Otherwise Objectionable, the true story of the most misunderstood law on the internet. In this episode, we're looking at how the Communications Decency Act fell apart.
We're talking about restrictions on speech that goes far beyond pornography, speech that should be freely available for adult communication.
And how Section 230 paved the way for the internet that we rely on today.
We definitely had a very vibrant army of contributors, and we knew that we were protected from being sued for anything they posted.
I personally think that Section 230 is perhaps the foundation of the entire internet.
We ended last episode with lawmakers Chris Cox and Ron Wyden getting their bill passed as part of the 1996 Telecommunications Act.
Simultaneous with modernizing the telecommunications laws in general, we have Section 230 that makes it possible for the internet to function freely.
But another part of that bill was Senator James Exon's anti-porn legislation known as the Communications Decency Act.
The key would be to come up with things that empowered parents rather than to get in the business of Mr. Exxon's censorship.
Remember that Section 230 was rolled into the CDA to appease both sides for the time being, but the two were functionally incompatible.
We were not thinking that Exxon could last.
Former California Congressman Chris Cox, co-author of Section 230.
It was facially, obviously, unconstitutional to so restrict communication between adults and to require that only things suitable for children could be said. Transmitting obscenity and child pornography was already illegal. So the draconian Exxon restrictions were just obviously unreasonable overkill. It was a command to do exactly the opposite of what our legislation provided for, and one of them had to go.
The CDA would face its first challenge just 4 months after the telecom bill was signed.
I was a young lawyer in Washington, D.C. I worked for a big firm, and I was a litigator. And I got kind of fascinated with the early internet.
If you've heard of Randall Boe, it's probably because he was briefly the commissioner of the Arena Football League. But back in 1996, he was following the early web and teaching himself Unix.
And I happened to meet a guy who ran, he described it as the first internet-only newspaper, and it was called The American Reporter.
The American Reporter was run by Joe Shea, and it claimed to be the first daily online-only newspaper that featured content written specifically for the net instead of just repurposing print news. Joe was reporting on the latest happenings in D.C., and he recognized that Exxon's part of the CDA amounted to censorship.
My client said, how can it be that I could publish the George Carlin's famous monologue, the seven dirty words you can never say on the radio or television, that I could print that in a paper newspaper or a magazine, and I would face no legal liability. And if I publish that same thing on the internet, I go to jail. So he actually did reprint the seven dirty words monologue. That was kind of our hook. And we challenged the statute on First Amendment grounds.
Randall and Joe took the CDA to court.
Our pitch was pretty simple. You have the most participatory, democratic, user-empowering communications medium that has yet been invented. And instead of applying the most expansive views of First Amendment law, you've applied a very restrictive view. You're going to treat it like cable TV, which seemed like exactly the wrong paradigm. And so that was our argument.
The government lawyers defended the CDA to Judge Jose Cabranes. Their strategy was inspired by Senator Exxon's Blue Book.
The government had an expert from the Air Force. He was going to come in and testify about all the terrible stuff that you could find on the internet. And, you know, how unsuspecting kids looking for Snow White were going to end up on porn sites. And so they came into the courtroom and, you know, we had a lot of spectators every day. And they are like, well, Your Honor, aren't you going to clear the court? And Judge Cabranes is like, why? It's a First Amendment case. I'm not going to clear the court. And they're like, well, we're going to put some stuff up here on the screens that it's a little... And he's like, do you have an objection, Mr. Bone? I'm like, no, it's fine with me. So we put it all up on the screens. It was quite a day there in the Southern District of New York. The people got quite a show.
The judges ruled 3-0 that the CDA infringed upon the right to free speech. Around the same time, a federal court in Pennsylvania also struck down part of the CDA, sending the case to the Supreme Court, where the ACLU fought to declare Exxon's law unconstitutional.
I actually went to the Supreme Court to watch the argument for that.
That's Stephen Levy, longtime internet reporter at Wired.
It's a non-trivial getting into see the Supreme Court if you're not a Supreme Court reporter. I was rooting for the ACLU. To me, this was freedom of speech on the internet. I mean, this was like a big deal.
Supporters from both sides rallied outside the courthouse. Parent groups chanted, but the ACLU had plenty of support.
But we are talking about restrictions on speech that goes far beyond pornography. We're talking about speech that should be freely available for adult communication.
How worried were people about that case when it was going?
They were worried. There it is. I mean, the Supreme Court just taking a case means there's a chance it's going to be, you know, ruled on either side. And it wasn't a case where, you know, people said they took it because they wanted to make a decision. They actually listened to the arguments.
The ACLU argued that the CDA went too far in censoring free speech. The government defended it by citing accepted rules for TV and radio, including the George Carlin case we heard earlier. Think about it. Is the internet really like radio? The George Carlin case revolved around unexpected exposure to those seven bad words. But on the internet, you have to click a link or type a URL to find content. The court called this a series of affirmative steps.
I think it's pretty clear from the arguments made that there are less restrictive means available to the government to protect children from inappropriate material, and certainly ways that would not infringe on the First Amendment rights of adults. I'd like to...
In June of 1997, the Supreme Court struck down the indecency parts of the Communications Decency Act. Only one section remained, 230. Chris Cox was overjoyed.
We were excited in part because of the statement that the Supreme Court made. I mean, we've been fighting Exxon, of course, in Congress. And so here's the Supreme Court now. So, you know, neutral justices telling us who's right and who's wrong. And they said that what Exxon was doing was worse than burning the house to roast the pig. I love that. They said that it cast a far darker shadow over free speech and threatened to torch a large segment of the internet community. It was more likely to interfere with the free exchange of ideas than to encourage it. So it was just a hands-down victory.
Everything that we have today was like a glimmer in someone's eye in 1996.
That's Randall Bowe again, the lawyer that challenged the CDA on behalf of the American Reporter.
I remember sitting in my office and looking at like the proto-internet when Amazon put up their first website. And the splash page was like, coming soon, Amazon, the world's biggest bookstore, and had a picture of the river. That was it. That was Amazon.com in 1996. I mean, it was all such a different world. I left my law firm in my partnership year to go to AOL. My then wife was like not very excited about that.
It was a risk. He had a solid job at a law firm and had just won a huge case against the government.
At the time when I went to AOL, they were still in an office park behind a Cadillac dealership in Tyson's Corner, Virginia. And my job was to build an in-house litigation function there.
AOL wasn't yet the internet giant it became, and they still had some technical challenges to work out.
You know, it was very much touch and go at the time. 1996 was the year of the 19-hour outage when we were offline for a whole day in August. It was hard, hard work. And of course, right after I got there, we went to unlimited pricing, and that led to the famous access crisis, the busy signal thing, where everyone in America was trying to get on, it seemed, trying to get on AOL, and the demand had so far outstripped our ability to grow the network. And it was uncorked by the simple decision to go from $9.95 a month and $2.95 an hour to $19.95 all you can eat.
The decision to switch to unlimited pricing had a major impact. Costs dropped, subscriptions rose, and user-generated content surged.
The most highly trafficked areas of the service were the message boards and the chat rooms. I mean, all of the areas of the service where the content was provided by the users. So we knew that was the whole shooting match right from the beginning, that the ability of users to participate in these kinds of discussions, to have their voices heard, to connect with other people was the power of the medium. And we saw that as what was actually going to transform it.
Randall also knew that their platform couldn't survive without moderation.
We had an in-house team that reviewed objectionable material. We wanted to be a place that was safe for kids. You know, we knew what was going on in the chat rooms. Like, we knew what people were doing and the non-family-friendly parts of it. But, you know, we invested a lot in making it a safe place to be because we were trying to persuade people this is okay.
Randall's job was handling any unforeseen legal challenges, and there were many.
We faced a situation where, like, there's no law against junk email. Like, what do you do? So we did a whole campaign against junk emailers. So we'd sue them, but then, like, they'd pop up again, you know, 3 months later. But, I mean, it was kind of fun because they were such a crazy group of people, and they would, like, hide gold. So I was like, you know what? Let's go get their stuff. Let's go actually go get the cars and the boats and the houses. When someone has a judgment, they can come take your stuff. Like, that's how it works in this country. So we went and we started taking their stuff, and that got their attention. In fact, we seized one guy's Porsche and then we raffled it off. We opened up a lottery for all America Online members, and you could enter. And then we had a drawing. It was like win a spammer's Porsche. So it was fun. It was fun. I got to give away the keys to a Porsche like a game show host. Like, you don't get to do that as a general counsel very often.
But it wasn't all fun and games.
One of the cases that was on the docket was the Zirin case, Zirin versus America Online. Now, the facts of the Zirin case are not great.
In 1995, just 6 days after the Oklahoma City bombing, an anonymous user posted something pretty terrible on AOL message boards. They were ads for merch with patently offensive slogans like, "Visit Oklahoma, it's a blast."
And they were all very tasteless jokes about the fact that these kids had been killed in this terrible terrorist bombing.
That's Ben Sapersky, a law professor at Fordham.
And it said, to buy a t-shirt, call Ken at, and then it gave some telephone number.
The ads listed the home phone number of a guy named Ken Zirin. Ken had absolutely no ties to these posts, but AOL's users didn't know that.
And some morning DJs in Oklahoma City saw it, thought it was outrageous, and said, hey, everyone should get after this Ken Zirin guy. Of course, it wasn't the real Ken Zirin. And the real Ken Zirin got like a zillion phone calls and harassed.
And he told AOL that it wasn't him, and he was getting all these calls and, in fact, death threats.
And he kept calling America Online saying, hey, can you stop this? And we couldn't. We had no idea who this was. And if you go back to that period of time, like, the credit card infrastructure was completely different. We didn't, you know, like, people would use fake credit cards all the time and you wouldn't catch up with it for quite a while. It was a whole different world. We did not have the tools that are available today to determine identities online because people weren't online.
So eventually he sued them.
AOL did eventually take down the posts, but the damage had been done. Ken Zirin sued.
I mean, they should have taken it down. And they eventually did, but there's no good reason why they didn't take it down earlier, as far as I know. The plaintiff said, we actually told them it was up there, and they had notice of it. And we proved it wasn't Mr. Zirin who put it there, and they could have just taken it down. So we're not seeking to treat them like the New York Times is treated. We're seeking actually to treat them a lot more like a bookstore might be treated if they have been selling some libelous book.
Lucky for Randall and AOL, Congress had passed a brand new law.
I'm digging into this, and I'm like, this is a Section 230 case. Why has someone not cited that? As a lawyer, I read the words of the statute that Congress passed, and the words in this case are fairly clear and unambiguous. No interactive service provider, meaning someone like America Online, could be treated as the speaker or publisher of content that was developed by a third party. And so that was always our argument. And so what the judge determined was that the content that created Mr. Zirin's injury was created by a user of America Online, not America Online, and thus there can't be liability against America Online.
He rejected the plaintiff's argument. He said the statute itself doesn't distinguish between publishers and distributors, and that it's a highly technical use of the term publisher to make that distinction. And what Congress had in mind was really a rather broad shield for the fledgling internet industry.
This case, Zirin v. AOL, was the first time Section 230 was applied in court.
You know, one of the arguments we made was if we have to review every single member profile and check out all the references in each one and make sure that they're true, well, I'm going to tell you there will not be member profiles because we won't be able to afford to do that. And they won't be interactive because it'll take us a few weeks to approve each one, right? I mean, it's just you can't do it. And as an interactive service provider, and we were maybe one of the largest at the time, and certainly were the largest eventually, like, we didn't have the resources to do that. It would have brought the service to a halt, to a crawl. AOL probably would have said, all right, well, since we have this liability and we don't have a technical way like, we're just going to have to close off third-party content. That would have been the answer. So I personally think that Section 230 is perhaps the foundation of the entire internet. Because if you imagine a world where companies like America Online would have been liable for the communications or thoughts or whatever of users, well, we simply couldn't have existed.
Entering the digital landscape of 2006, it's impossible to overlook the buzz surrounding MySpace.
YouTube has become this sort of mirror of our culture, right?
Cheers. Oh my God.
These buckets are filled with grapes. What kind of grapes?
Fast forward a decade or so past that first Section 230 case. It's the mid-2000s, and one site is starting to get a lot of attention.
On college campuses, it's called the Facebook Trance. To everyone else, it's spending too much time in front of your computer, glued to a website called thefacebook.com.
You see someone that you might recognize, you click on them, and then you see that they're friends with someone else, and you share all these common interests.
When we first launched, we were hoping for, you know, maybe 400, 500 people. And now we're at 100,000 people, so who knows where we're going next.
My wife, she had been working at a yarn store selling yarn and got a job doing customer support at Facebook.
Meet Dave Wilner, the author of Facebook's first community standards. He first heard about the company through his wife.
Her mother sold somebody a house, and they were like, oh, my kid's working at this website. They pay more than the yarn store. And about 6 to 9 months into that, she was like, you know, I think this Facebook thing might work out, and I'm pretty sure I could get you a job because we're hiring just like 12 people a month in a company of like 200 people just to try to support this website because we're desperately behind and don't know how to scale.
Dave was very computer savvy and had been doing tech support for a financial data product. He flew out to California and got the job. His early responsibilities at Facebook were not very glamorous.
It was resetting people's passwords by hand because iPhones weren't ubiquitous. So if you wanted to do two-factor authentication, you had to write to me and I asked you your security question, which was extremely boring. And as that team continued to grow after I joined, we sort of had this problem of keeping everybody on the same page.
Dave recognized that as Facebook grew, it had more abuse to deal with, and they needed some order to their process.
You need to start to document like what the rules are. It can't just kind of be vibes and the consensus of some college students, which is fine if your website is for college students, but if it's becoming for everybody, particularly everybody globally, you have to start to think through, okay, how are we going to handle this increasingly broad array of issues we're confronting. So the initial project was sort of backing out a explanation that would produce the current set of things we were doing. So it was like, step one, what's the embedded logic in what we're currently doing? Step two, okay, now let's actually try to revise and steer that in an intentional way.
Facebook had a short list that Dave described as a ban on, quote, Hitler and naked people. So he took that and turned it into a catalog of slurs, crimes, and otherwise objectionable content that is still banned on Meta.
And then we were adding more and more people, so they had more and more questions, and we were encountering more and more varieties of content, and so it just sort of became this ever-growing task that went from a project to a part-time responsibility to, okay, now you're a people manager with a team. And as often happens when you embark on something without fully understanding the consequences, that project never ended, and now I guess it's been 20 years.
Dave left his job at Facebook more than a decade ago, and he isn't responsible for the moderation policies that are making headlines today. But back then, he and his band of moderators looked to Section 230 as their legal reference point.
Early in the process, I asked legal, like, what should we be doing here? And their response was basically like, well, Section 230 means we have a lot of discretion and we're lawyers. So we don't We don't really do that. We're busy over here with copyright. Like, I don't know, man. Like, do whatever you want. Because the actual legal framework is like, you can take things down for these underspecified reasons or like anything you might otherwise find objectionable, which means just literally nothing or anything. But they didn't need to be doing it, and they're more expensive. Right. So I ended up doing it.
You're cheaper than the lawyers.
I was a lot cheaper than the lawyers at the time, yeah.
So in some ways, Section 230 sort of gave you that freedom to...
It creates the space right. within which my entire professional life has existed.
It wasn't just platforms like Facebook and YouTube that benefited. A whole new type of news content emerged.
I started a local New York political blog that was the only one. And for like a year, it was so amazing.
That's Ben Smith, co-founder of Semaphore and former head of BuzzFeed News. But he started out on a platform called Blogger.
Like I could go to a press conference at like 11 at City Hall, go to lunch, come back and write what had happened at the press conference. And then it would be the only way to find out about what had happened at the press conference until the New York Times published at midnight if they felt like writing it. I thought it would be like 200 people. It turned out to be like 2,000 people who cared about sort of micro city political doings. It just became the center of the universe. And it was so much fun to host this conversation among this kind of city's political class. Because it was just this sort of magical moment of there being only one place where this digital conversation was happening. And that really hooked me.
Did you have comments on the blog?
Yes, and they were really savage and out of control. And they were all coming from like bored staffers of the New York City Council trashing each other.
Ben would go on to work at Politico before he was poached in 2011 by BuzzFeed.
I mean, it was enormous fun. And it was an era of venture-backed media. You know, it was just this sense that growth was the only goal. There were no revenue targets. The point was to grow and to build an audience and to, you know, delight people and to get people interested in what we were doing, you know, and sort of cost no object.
230 wasn't entirely on Ben's radar, but the spirit of it definitely was.
I think I intuited it. I'd always figured you were allowed to write whatever the hell you want on the internet and hadn't thought about it very much. I don't remember having a lot of conversations about Section 230 specifically at BuzzFeed, but we definitely had a very vibrant army of contributors. And we knew that we were protected from being sued for anything they posted. And I don't think, and that was never in doubt for us.
I mean, it definitely existed in creating the space for Airbnb to function.
After Facebook, Dave Wilner joined another major platform that benefits from Section 230.
Probably the place where it came up most actually was reviews. Because with Airbnb, you're leaving star ratings and you're leaving written reviews. And as is the nature of all things, people then have fights about that. But as Airbnb, your ability to adjudicate, like, how am I supposed to figure out while being on the internet whether or not your house smells? How is that going to work? Like, what does that even mean?
Right.
But also, it's a problem for you if a bunch of people said your house was stinky.
Which ties back to what policy expert Jessica Malugin laid out for us in the beginning of the series.
Do you know what is, like, super useful on Airbnb? Reviews. If Airbnb were potentially liable for every lawsuit, they would never host those reviews.
I think that if you had a situation where it was even easier to pressure companies to take down negative reviews, the online review landscape would be even less trustworthy than it already is, which I would say is like mid at best. My basic understanding of what just a no Section 230 universe would look like would basically be like companies fleeing towards doing nothing at all, which I just don't think is viable. Companies are going to have to moderate spam, which means they're going to have to moderate. Like the ambient background radiation of the internet universe is spam and porn.
Yeah.
And any design which fails to accommodate or account for channeling that energy is doomed. It just right. is. And I don't think a Section 230-less universe is super compatible with that.
Coming up, Section 230 meets a new political movement, and we hear how other countries handle speech on the internet.
You can imagine someone like Mark Zuckerberg being prosecuted elsewhere, not being feted and showered with billions of dollars in venture capital.
The internet was born in the United States, right? So it's kind of like, whether we like it or not, the US is like the central hub for all of the internet?
All of these things, I think, we take for granted. And if we imagine a world without them, well, we don't have to imagine it. We can just move and see that world. And it's not a better world.